Good morning. Please join me in prayer. O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, beloved Jesus Christ, blessed Master, saints and sages of all religions, I bow to all of you. Free my life from all obstacles. And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development. Make my mind thy temple. Make my heart thy altar. Make my love thy home. Be thou the only King. Reigning on the throne of my consciousness. Amen. It's wonderful to be here this morning after all the weather we've had over the last few weeks. That I would reread to you a New Year's wish from Swami Satchidananda that was sent out by the ashram. May the new year bring you all new hopes, more intensive aspiration to realize the truth, deeper devotion to Him, and a serious effort to reach, before many more new years dawn, the goal, the great goal, which is infinite and eternal, where there is no calendar to mark the new year. While wishing to speed up, let us not forget that the divinity we aim at is not far away in the heavens, but seated in every one of us humans, animals, all beings and creatures. So, without loving and serving our brethren, who are forms of the One, our effort to realize the One will be futile. There is a saying in Malayalam, the translation of which is, running after the Creator, ignoring the creation will result in losing both. This warns us that if we do not love and serve His creations, the humanity and all the beings and creatures, if we do not develop the qualities of a real devotee and create real harmony and love amongst ourselves, our sadhana will not bear fruit, i.e., we will not be able to remain absorbed in meditation of the Lord all the 24 hours. May the blessings of our beloved Papa be upon every one of you to qualify yourself to be a devotee, and then to run fast to Him who is ready to acknowledge you as His own. Swami Satchidananda. It takes a great soul to be able to put ultimate truth so succinctly. And of great souls that have walked this earth, Swami Ramatirtha was one of the greatest. Both Papa and Master took great inspiration from Swami Ramatirtha. He was a saint who was born in India in the mid-1800s, and he came to America in the early 1900s. And he gave talks that absolutely thrilled and uplifted the people who listened to him. He traveled all across the United States. He spent longer times of meditation in Northern California. And through the talks and the inspiration that he gave, he helped to prepare the way for the great change that was coming to America. Swami Vivekananda was perhaps the first of the great masters to come here to America. And when he spoke at the Congress of Religious Liberals, he came without invitation. There was no one here to receive him. He showed up on a train in Chicago where the conference was to begin. He didn't realize when he came that he needed an invitation in order to speak. And he came without portfolios, so to speak, without any great recommendations from those in his own country. He didn't know where to go or what to do, and he just started wandering up and down the streets of Chicago. And as he was passing by one particular house in a nice neighborhood, a woman spotted this strange-looking Asian man in his orange robe walking outside. And she went outside and she said, "Are you here for the Congress of Religious Liberals?" And he said, "Yes." And she said, "Well, come in. Have something to eat and rest." He had nothing to eat for several days. And so she fed him and gave him rest and gave him an introduction to a man in New York who was able to write a letter of introduction for him to be able to speak. And when he came out onto the stage, he absolutely electrified that crowd. Where before many have gone on in long terms and speaking in monotonous voices, and he is the very last speaker to speak, and as anybody who's ever spoken in a venue, you know that if you're the last one after 3 long days of speeches, you're not necessarily going to be the one who gets the crowd on fire. People perhaps have already left and gone. Others are a little worn out from all the speeches. But when he came on, something magnificent happened. And through the electrifying aspect of that crowd, he was invited to many other speeches, and so began his sojourn, both here and in England. And Swami Ramatirtha came at a later date, and finally Master. And so both Swami Vivekananda and Ramatirtha had laid the groundwork for Master. And Master, of course, came with the blessings of his great gurus and at the behest of both Babaji and Jesus to bring original Christianity to this West. It is not a new interpretation. Rather, it is what Christ meant from the very beginning. He did not come to proclaim himself as the one and only, but rather he came to awaken that knowledge and that spirit within every individual who walks the earth. Because mankind could not properly receive the message that Jesus brought, gradually the message devolved into, this is about a singular human being who came so many years ago, and you must worship him, and at some unspecified date, you will resurrect in him. The truth is that the Christ Spirit is to be resurrected within the soul now, here, not at some later date and time. But who can receive this great and awesome message that comes from such a great God-man? We all struggle with our own inner human self. We know who we are. We know the mistakes that we have made. We know the weaknesses that we feel. And it is not until you can fully receive the divinity within yourself, not from an egotistical, arrogant, self-assuming kind of a way, but in a way that's real, a way that is of a tremendous experience within you. And when you are lifted up into these divine realms, it takes you someplace new, a place you have never been before. You may have intuitively apprehended it, that it was possible that you could have this, but you don't know it. You don't really know it until you experience it. And not just for brief moments, but until you can live in that consciousness of Christ. This is the perfect, pure light of God within you. Jesus said, "Be ye perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect." Now, can any individual hope to rise to that level of perfection? And from a human standpoint, we would say no. We're filled with imperfection. So did he give us an impossible task? Did he give us a saying that no one could possibly follow? And the reality is, he gave us a path that we can all follow. He gave us something that we can all realize. We can realize the perfection within us. And when you have that realization, you come to know that you are made up of God stuff. You are not human only. But you are also divine. So reading from Happiness Within, by Swami Ramatirtha. This is a lecture delivered on December 17, 1902, in the Academy of Sciences in San Francisco, California. And he begins, "My own self, in the form of ladies and gentlemen, Rama does not blame European or Christian nations for their cohorts and armies to conquer other nations. That is also a stage in the spiritual development of a nation, which at one time is necessary. India had to pass through that stage, but India, being a very old nation, has weighed the riches of the world in the balance and found them wanting. And the same will be the experience of these nations that are in these days for accumulating worldly prosperity and riches. Why are all these nations trying to march cohorts to conquer other nations? What do they seek in all that? The only thing sought is happiness, joy, pleasure. It is true that some people say they do not seek happiness but knowledge. Others say that they seek not happiness, they seek action. That is all very good, but examine the hearts and minds of average men or of ordinary mortals. You will find that the ultimate goal which they all set before them, the ultimate goal they all seek directly or indirectly, consciously or unconsciously, it is happiness, nothing but happiness. Let us examine this evening where happiness resides, whether happiness lives in the palace or in the cottage, whether happiness dwells in the charms of women or in things that gold and silver can buy. Where is the native home of happiness? Happiness also has a history of its own. There are great traveling days. Steam and electricity have annihilated time and space. Great traveling days these are, and everybody writes an account of his travels. Happiness also travels. Let us have something of the travels of happiness. We start with the first glimpse of the happiness that a child has in his infancy. All the happiness in this world is for the child located in the skirt or of the mother, or in the bosom of the dear mother. All the happiness is located there. This is the first stage on the main road which happiness has to travel along, the mother's skirt or the mother's bosom, say. To the infant, there is nothing in the world which brings happiness so much as the mother's bosom. The child hides his face behind the skirts of the mother, and there he says, "Look, look, find me out, where am I?" And he laughs heartily. He laughs with all of his heart and soul. Books are meaningless to the child. Treasures are useless to him. Fruits and sweets have no taste for the child that has not yet been weaned. The whole world of pleasure is, for the child, concentrated there. A year passes, and the happiness of the child changes its center. It moves on to some things else. The residence of happiness now becomes the toys, the beautiful toys, Pollies and Dollies. In the second stage, the child does not like the mother so much as he likes his own toys. Sometimes the child quarrels with the dear mother, for the sake of toys, for the sake of dollies. A few months or years more, and no more is his happiness in the Pollies and Dollies. It has shifted its center again. It is no longer located in these things. In the third stage, when the child grows up to be a boy, happiness is located for him in books, especially storybooks. This is the case with an ordinary intelligent child. Sometimes it is in other things, but we are talking about the ordinary case. Now the storybooks engross all the love and affection of the boy. Now the toys, dollies, and pollies lose their charms. Storybooks take their place, and he finds them beautiful and attractive. But happiness travels on. The schoolboy enters the college, and in college life his happiness is found in something else, say in scientific books and philosophical works. He reads them for some time, but his happiness has traveled from books to the longing of seeking honors in the university. His desire is to reach the residence of his happiness, the headquarters of his joy. The student comes out of the university with flying colors. He gets a lucrative post, and the happiness of this young man centered in money. In riches. Now the one dream of his life is to accumulate riches, to be rich. He wants to become a big man, to amass a large fortune. When he gets some wealth for working in the office for a few years, his happiness passes into something else. What is that? Need that be told? It is a woman. Now the young man wants to have a wife, and for the sake of a wife, he is ready to spend away his riches. The mother's skirt no longer gives him any happiness. The toys have no charm for him, and the storybooks are cast aside. And these are read only on those occasions when they are expected to give him some insight into the nature of that dream of his life, the woman. He is all sacrifice for the sake of his wife. Hard-earned riches are cast to the winds for the sake of a pretty whims of what was now the headquarters of his happiness. The young man lives for some time with the woman, and lo, the happiness is sighted a little yonder. The pleasure he could derive from the thought of his wife in the beginning, he no longer gets now. Taking the case of an ordinary youth of India, the happiness of youth now passes from the woman onto the coming child. Now child becomes the dream of his life. He wants to have a child, an angel, a seraph, a cherub, in the house. Raman knows not much of the state of affairs in this country, but in India, after marrying, people pray to God and yearn for a child. They do that, all that lies in their power, to seek the aid of doctors and to invoke the blessings of holy men, all that they can do in order to be blessed with a child. In the expectation of the child concentrates all the happiness of the youth. The child is in the sixth stage in his travel of happiness, in the march of joy. The youth is then blessed with a child. His joy knows no bounds. He is full of spirits. He springs up to his feet. He is elated. He is, as it were, raised above the earth many feet. He does not walk. He swims in the air, so to speak. His soul is full of happiness when he gets a child. In the sixth stage, in the moon-faced child, the happiness of the grown-up youth has reached in a very way its acme. The intensest happiness is when he sees the face of his child. The happiness of an ordinary man has reached its zenith. After that, the youth begins to decline in spirits. The child becomes a grown-up boy, and the charm is lost. The happiness of this man will go on traveling from object to object, sometimes located in this thing, at other times residing in that thing. But the intensity of happiness in the objects with which an ordinary man will not be so strong as it is in the love of his own child. Now, let us examine whether happiness really dwells in the objects like these. The mother's skirt, dollies and pollies, books, riches, woman, child, or any object or anything of this world at all. Before proceeding further, let us liken the traveling happiness to the traveling sunlight. Sunshine also travels from place to place. It is at one time shining all over India, and at another time on Europe. It travels on. When the shades of the evening fall, see how rapidly the sunshine shifts from place to place. It shines on Eastern America, and it travels on to its west. See how the sunlight goes skipping on tiptoe, slipping from land to land, and is then seen spreading its luster on Japan, and so on. The sunshine travels on from place to place, but all these different places where the sunshine is seen are not at the source, the home of sunshine. The home of sunshine must be somewhere else. The home of sunshine is the sun. Similarly, let us examine happiness which goes on traveling from object to object like the sunshine. Whence does it proceed? Where is its real home? Let us look at the sun of happiness, as it were. Take the case of the gentleman who has been blessed with a child. This gentleman is sitting in his office. He is busy with official duties, and all of a sudden he hears the ding-ding of the bell. What bell? The telephone bell. He jumps up to his feet and goes to the telephone. But when he is about to hear what message may be, his heart beats. They say coming calamities cast their shadows before. His heart beats. Never was it so with him before. He reaches up to the telephone and hears a message. Oh, what a distressing message it must have been. The gentleman was panting and sobbing. He lost all presence of mind. His cheeks lost all color. And with a pallid, cadaverous face, he came rapidly to his seat, wore on his coat and hat, and went out of the office, as it were, like shot like a bullet from a gun. He did not even ask the consent of his chief officer, the head of the department. He did not even exchange a word with the servants in the room. He did not even lock up the papers which were lying on the desk. He lost all presence of mind and went straight out of the office. All his fellow officials were astounded. He reached the street and saw a car running before him. He ran up to the car, and there he met a postman who gave him a letter. This letter brought him happy news, if in the circumstances it can be called happy news from a worldly point of view, the happy news of a large fortune having fallen to his lot. The man had bought a share in a lottery, and about $10,000 had fallen to his lot. This news ought to have cheered him up, ought to have filled him with joy, but it didn't. It didn't. The message he had received over the telephone was weighing heavily on his heart. This news brought him no pleasure. He found in the same car one of the greatest officials in the state, sitting just right in front of him. This was an official to have an interview with whom he had been one dream of his life. But look here, the gentleman did not exchange glances with the official. He turned his head away. He also noticed the sweet face of a lady friend. It had been the ambition of this gentleman's life to meet her and exchange words with her. But now he is insensible to her sunny smiles. Well, Rama ought not to keep him in a state of suspense so long, nor should you be kept in a suspense any longer. He reached the street where his house was located, and a great noise and tumult was there, and he saw clouds of smoke rising to the sky and veiling the sun. He saw tongues of fire going up to the heavens. He saw his wife, grandmother, mother, and other relatives weeping and bewailing the conflagration which was consuming their house. He saw all his relations there, but missed one thing. He missed then the metropolis of his happiness. He missed the dear little baby. He missed the sweet little child. He was not there. He asked about the child, and the wife could make no answer. She simply answered by sobbing and crying. She could make no articulate answer. He found out the truth. He came to know that the child had been left in the house, that the child was with the nurse at the time of the fire began. The nurse had placed the child in the cradle. The child was asleep, and the nurse had left the room. Now the inmates of the house, being panic-stricken at the sight of the fire consuming the house, had quitted the house in haste, each thinking that the child must be with some other inmate of the house. All of them came out, and now they found that the child was left in the room, which was then being enveloped by fire. There is crying and gnashing of teeth, cutting of lips, beating of breasts, but no help. Here this gentleman and his wife, his mother and friends, and the nurse were crying aloud to the people, to the standers-by, to the policemen, and asking them to save their child, to rescue their dear little baby. Save our dear little child any way you can. Will you give away? We will give away all of our property. We will give you all the wealth that we may accumulate within 10 years from today. We will give it all up. Save our child. Save our child. They are willing to give up everything for the sake of the child. Indeed, the child is a sweet little thing. The dear little baby is a very sweet thing. And it is worthwhile to sacrifice all our property, all our wealth, and all of our interests for the sake of the child. But Rama asks one thing. Is the child the source of happiness, the sweetest thing in the world? Or is the source of happiness somewhere else? Mark here. Everything is being sacrificed for the child. But it is not the child itself being sacrificed for something higher, for something else. Wealth is given away, riches are given away, prosperity is given away for the child, but the child has been given away for something else. Even the lives of those people who may venture to jump into the fire may be lost, but even that dear little child is being sacrificed for something else, for something higher. and that something else must be of necessity be sweeter than the child. That something else must be the real center of happiness, must be the real source of happiness. And what is that something? Just see. They did not jump into the fire themselves. That something is the self, with a capital S. If they jump into the fire themselves, they sacrifice themselves, and they are not prepared to do. On the child is everything else sacrificed. On the self, the child is sacrificed. We now see the highest stage of happiness. The child has not happiness in itself. The child is beautiful, lovely, and the source of happiness because the child is blessed with the sunshine which proceeds from the self. That sunshine was not inherent in the child itself. If that sunshine of happiness had been inherent in the child, it would have lasted in the person of the child forever. Notice that the sunshine which brightened the face of the child proceeded from a source within, the source within the self. Here we come to a little nearer to the source of happiness, to the home of happiness. Not for the sake of the child is the child dear. The child is dear for the sake of the self. Not for the sake of the wife is the wife dear. Not for the sake of the husband is the husband dear. The wife is dear for the sake of the self. The husband is dear for the sake of the self. This is the truth. People say they love a thing for its own sake, but this cannot be. This cannot be. Not for the sake of wealth is wealth dear. Wealth is dear for the sake of the self. When the wife, who is dear at one time, does not serve the interest of the husband, she is divorced. When the husband, who is dear at one time, does not serve the interests of the wife, he is divorced. When wealth does not serve the purpose, it is given up. You know the case of Nero. He did not see that the beautiful Rome, that metropolis of his, was of much interest to him, was of much use to him. To him, it was of greater interest to see the conflagration, to see it was of more interest to see a big bonfire. Look here. He went up on top of the adjoining hill and asked his friends to go and set the whole city on fire in order that he might enjoy the sight of a grand conflagration. Here was his fiddling while Rome was burning. Thus we see that even wealth is divorced, given up, when it does not serve our interests. Rama was an eyewitness of a very strange phenomenon, a very curious phenomenon. There is a great flood, a great inundation of the river Ganga, and the river went on rising. Here, on the branches of a tree, was sitting several monkeys. There is a female monkey and some children of this female monkey. All these children came up to the monkey. The water rose up to the place where the monkey was seated. Then the she-monkey jumped to a higher branch. The water came up to that place. The female monkey came up to the highest top branch, and the water rose even up to that place. All the children were clinging to the body of the female monkey. The water reached her feet. Then she took hold of one child, one baby monkey, and placed it underneath her feet. The water rose still higher. And then this female monkey took hold of another child and placed it under her feet. The water still rose, and the third child was also taken and mercilessly placed under her feet to save herself. Just so it is. People and things are dear to us as long as they serve our interests, our purposes. The very moment that our interests are at stake, we sacrifice everything. Thus we come to the conclusion that the seat of happiness, the source of happiness, is somewhere within the self. The home of happiness is somewhere in the self. But where is it? Is it in the feet? The feet support the whole body. It may be in the feet, but no, it is not in the feet. Had it been in the feet ought to have been the dearest thing in the world. Of course, the feet are dearer than anything else outside, but they are also not so dear as the hands are. In the home of happiness, in the hands are dearer than the feet, but they are not the home of happiness. Then is happiness located in the nose or in the eye? The eyes are dearer than the hands or the nose, but the happiness is not located in them. Think of something that is dearer even than your eyes. You might say, it is life. Rama says, take the whole body first. The whole body is not the home of happiness. We see that this whole body, we are changing every moment. In several years, every particle of the body is replaced by a new principle, a new particle. It may be in the intellect, in the brain, in the mind. It may be there, but let us see if there is not something even dearer than the intellect. Let us examine that. If there be something which is dearer and sweeter even than the intellect, then that may be the home of happiness. We say that life, or as in the Hindus put it, prana, may be the source of happiness, because oftentimes people want to live even at the sacrifice of their reasoning powers. Here is a choice between two alternatives, die altogether or live like a crazy lunatic man. Everybody will choose the alternative of life, even in a crazy lunatic frame. Thus, we see that the intellect or the intelligence is sacrificed at the altar of life. Then life, personal life, may be the home of happiness, the sun from which all happiness emanates. Just examine whether life is really the home of happiness or not. Vedanta says, no, no, even life is not the home of happiness. The home of happiness, the heavens within, is higher up still, even beyond individual personal life. Where is it then? Rama once saw a young man at the point of death. He is suffering from a very bad disease. There was excruciating pain in his body. The pain began in the toes up to the feet. At first it was not so great, but after a while it kept coming up, and then his body was undergoing a hysterical movement. Gradually the pain came up to the knees, and then rose up higher through the dreadful pain, reached the stomach. And when the pain reached the heart, the man died. The last words this young man uttered were these, oh, when shall this life leave me? When shall these pranas leave me? These were the words of that young man. You know, in this country, you say, he gave up the ghost. In India, we say, he gave up the body. This shows the difference. Here the body is looked upon as the self, and the ghost is looked upon as something tacked on. In India, the body is looked upon as something foreign to the spirit. The real self is looked upon as the reality. There, when the body dies, nobody believes that he dies. The body changes. He does not perish. And so these words that escaped the man, the lips of the youth, were, oh, when shall I give up this life? When shall this prana leave me? Here we have something higher even than life, something superior to prana, something which says, my life, something which says, my prana, something which possesses the prana and which is above the prana or life. And that something is sweeter by far than the individual personal life or prana. Here we see that the prana or life in that particular body did not serve the interests of the higher self, or of the self higher than prana. The prana, or the life, was sacrificed. The prana, or life, was thrown off. Here we see something which is superior to prana or life, for which life is sacrificed. This must be, by all means, sweeter by far than life, even, and that must be the home of Anand, or happiness. There must be the source, the origin of our joy. Now we see why prana or life is sweeter than intellect, because pranas are nearer to the real self, the self within. Why is it that the intellect is sweeter than the eyes? Because the intellect is nearer to the real self than the eyes. And why is it that the eyes are dearer than the feet? Because the eyes partake more of the real self in you than the feet do. Why is it that everybody looks upon his child as being far more beautiful than the child of somebody else, of his neighbor? Vedanta says, because this particular child you call mine, you have gilded a little with the gold of your real self. Any book in which you may write a line of your own self, any work that contains something contributed by your pen, appears to you to be far more worthy than any other book, even if it came from the pen of Plato. Why is it? Because this book, which you call mine, has the sunshine of your real self in it. I think this is a wonderful, wonderful talk. And draws out through stories and analogies the truth in a wonderful way. I'd like to speak to you about the inescapable conclusion. In my position, I get to hear about many people's lives, their private lives, their interior lives, the lives of those others that touch them. We are all privy to different lives, to the inner lives of people at various times. And we can see that this life brings many great gifts with it. But if those gifts are squandered and abused and let go of, there is a very great loss, not only for that individual, but for all people. There's a man who deals in the commodity markets, and it came to him to be a kind of an obsession, a kind of gambling that went on within him. And rather than practicing good business principles, he went on to go further and further until he had mortgaged his house to the hilt. He had sacrificed everything, always hoping to get that one big hit, that thing that would lift him out of what are now become dire circumstances. Before, he is all right. He had earned quite a lot of money. But things had turned against him. You might say luck or fate had turned against him. And so instead of exercising good judgment, he is ruled by this idea that all he had to do was hit the big one, and he would be back in the game once again. And with that came a ruination of that family's finances, and they had to sell the family home and everything that went with it. And it affected a great many people. There are others. There's one who rose up into very high spiritual development. And normally we think as someone goes up higher and higher, that all the other difficulties and problems and habits just automatically drop off. But this isn't the case. Because at every stage in our development, there comes great temptations. Sometimes it comes through drugs, alcohol, sometimes through sex. Whatever it is that appeals to that individual the most. The devil is sometimes pictured as an individual who comes and whispers in your ear. And this is a pictorial sense of what comes about, what we choose to do in the privacy of our own lives. And perhaps alcohol becomes a basis for living because the stress, even of spiritual experiences, are tremendous. And so alcoholism becomes a part of that person's life. And as a result, they not only stunt their own spiritual growth, but they begin to go backwards. The mind and the will grow weaker, not stronger. The realization of the self begins to dim. What before was a great light now becomes like a dim light bulb, and perhaps even to extinguishing it and making it go out. There are others who are given great gifts along in life. One who came from a difficult childhood in a family sense, but was given many advantages. And when he entered into the schools of higher education, threw away the opportunities that had been given to him. And so these things go on. We make choices. Every single day, we make choices about what we think will bring us happiness. Everybody is looking for happiness. Everybody is looking for the right formula. And for those who are willing to sacrifice, those who are willing to stay true to themselves and to their higher calling, they will go through difficult times. In one case, an individual was starting out their own business and they took out large loans in order to support it. And not all the money was spent on the business. They were spent on other things. And when the business didn't grow in the way that it should be, they began to lose everything that they had. In another case, a businessman was really going through a difficult straits, nothing of his own doing. He got caught in the middle of other people's legal actions. And he began to sell off everything that he could in order to pay his employees and keep the business going. And it was an incredibly difficult time. But gradually he weathered through the storm and he came out of it all right. And now business is better than ever. When we adhere to solid principles in our life, we are then the recipients of the things that we have done. Now, it doesn't mean, obviously, as in all of these cases, that everything goes smoothly. But for those who live their lives with integrity, those who live according to their own highest light, they are drawn through those difficult circumstances, and eventually they come out of them. And when they do, they come out better than they went into them with. How many circumstances do we know of where there has been illness, where there's been economic downturns, where there have been other kinds of difficulties that have come? And the individual will say later on, usually after recovery, that was one of the best things that ever happened for me. Because somehow I had gotten off track, but this deepened my spiritual journey and my path. It deepened my walk with God. Now, whenever something happens, we have a choice to make. We can look on the outside and we can become afraid. We can see nothing but darkness. We can see nothing but lack of opportunity all around us. Or we can turn the mind within. We can draw more deeply from the divine source that will give us strength, that will give us light, that will give us wisdom, the knowledge of what to do in dire circumstances. Now, in the first case, where the mind is turned outward, spiritual advantage is lost. But in the latter case, where the mind is turned inward, spiritual growth occurs. Now, many times, people who have gone through great difficulties open themselves up to a greater degree as never before. They feel their complete hopelessness and helplessness in a particular situation. They have to turn their mind within. They have to turn it to God. There's no place else to go. Now, those who absolutely refuse to go inside and find that inner source of strength, they may come to the place where they commit suicide or such depression takes them over that they never come back out of it. Now, it doesn't mean that somebody who goes into the spiritual path will never experience any of these difficulties or have depression. In fact, there is a time, in the case of most people's paths, when there is a scouring out of the inner cup, and you may go through a down time. You may go down into a time, into an inner hell, where there is darkness, where there is hopelessness, where there is helplessness. And if you will quickly accede to your hopelessness, your helplessness, and know that in your human self, you are not able to do everything for yourself. In humility, you open yourself to the grace of God and Gurus. You know that your power is limited, but God's power is unlimited. And if you will open yourself in this way and allow that grace to come in and begin to change you and transform you and to take you onto a journey, you will grow. You will become greater in God. And you will come out of it more realized, stronger than ever before. So we have a choice. We have a choice. But it is really remarkable how we cling on to that which does not work in our lives. How we cling on to old, worn-out ideas. Old theories that do not produce happiness for us, and yet we are so loath to let them go. We all have our own little places of attachment, our own little pet theories, and we don't want them challenged. We don't want to change them. We don't want to let go of what's known. We may be miserable where we're at, but we don't want to move for fear that we'll end up in a worse place. But in order to grow spiritually, in order to grow in God, we must have the courage, first of all, to take responsibility. The reason we are where we are is because we have brought ourselves to that state. Now, there may be things in the outside world we can point to. And we say, well, this is a difficult thing. And this other causes me stress and all kinds of problems. And if these things weren't there, then I wouldn't have this kind of feeling of stress. And to some degree, there's a truth to that. But real freedom, as Swami Ramatirtha points out here, resides in the self. It doesn't reside in any of these outside things, not even things of the body, which we consider very near and dear to us. When we realize that real happiness, the real source of contentment, comes from that deep self within, even beyond our own life. Our own life is limited, but God within us is unlimited. It is the true self. When I was driving down this morning, I was listening to the Om. It comes in such a beautiful way. In many traditions, the Sikhs, for instance, listening to the Om and looking for the light of God are the two primary ways of purifying the mind and preparing it for this great inner kingdom. And when you listen to this Om, it comes in as a high-pitched sound, and it comes in and you can mark exactly how it courses through your being, how it comes into the brain, how it moves from the brain and down through the spinal cord, and then goes out throughout this entire body. And it gives you life. It gives you the ability to operate in this body. And yet, for all of us, there comes a time when we will leave this body. It's a wonderful story about Voltaire living in France. He's an elderly man in his 80s, and there was a rumor that went out that he was dead. And he responded to the rumor, and he said, although he is still very much living, he said, the rumor is true. It's just premature. And isn't that true for us all? You're to say the body is dead. Well, it's true. It's just premature. It's going to happen to us all. So it's a great sword of discrimination that comes to us. It's a great sword. And it should cut through the delusion of all these things that we hang on to or try to hang on to. Now, sometimes we hang on to things in absentia, not because we have them, but because we yearn for them. And we think, only if I had this or that or the other thing, then I would be happy, then I would be at peace, then I would be content. But if you really examine the lives of people who already have those things that you imagine would make you so happy, do they experience that total peace and contentment? And I think the answer in most cases would be no. And if it did come to them, then they would not identify that as the source of their happiness, if they were truly happy. There have been individuals who have won the lottery. And for most people, they would think, well, my troubles are over now. And for these few individuals, their lives changed absolutely not at all. They continue to live as they lived. They set the money aside. They continue to go about their life as they were, because they are already happy. Now, the money may be used for some good purpose or another, but they are willing to be content and wait for that purpose to reveal itself. Can you imagine having such a state in which you could be like that with any amount of money at all? When Yogananda's father received back payment for work that he'd done that he'd never put in overtime for, He received in India what amounted to that time as $40,000. So that's a huge fortune at that time, in those earlier years and in that country. And he took it without a comment. And it wasn't until later that his brother, Yogananda's brother, noticed going through the papers that there is this large deposit into the banking account. So he asked his father about it. He says, yes, what is it? What of such money? What does that mean to any of us? So great was his dispassion for these amounts. Now, he led a comfortable life already. And yet, most people, if they're ensconced in much money, they want more money. I used to work with a salesman who said something humorous. If somebody that we all knew to be fairly well-to-do came into the store, he'd tell him, he says, if I had your money, I'd throw my money away. But who would do that? Who would think of such a thing? It's funny because it's so ironic. Nobody would think of such a thing. We all want more, huh? And is there any end to it? And does it, can that be close to the self? Can that be close to the self? So I think this inescapable conclusion comes when you really clarify where the sun of happiness, your happiness, really resides. And when you know that it is in the self, in your God self within you, then it is not hard to let go of many of these false attachments that we have imagined the sun of happiness as being at the core of our life. I cannot tell you what a great freedom comes over you when you are able to truly identify that the sun of happiness exists right inside of you, and you come to the inescapable conclusion that this is where happiness really resides, and it's something that you can take with you, whether you are living, whether you have left the body, whatever the case is, it can be with you in prosperity and in poverty, whatever comes to you. It can come to you when you are with friends and family and enjoying the warmth of hearth and home. And it can come to you when you are alone and an outcast and somewhere where you do not want to be. It can be with you at all times and all places and all circumstances. And what else in this world could promise such a thing? Let us chant for a few moments, wonderful Sri Ram, and feel that as we are chanting it, that we are speaking to the infinite love of our own heart, that we are singing to God. And we're singing with an open heart in such a way that we hope that it is pleasing to Him. Not necessarily to the ears of man, but pleasing to the heart of God. Shri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram, 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 Shri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram. Shri Rama Jai Ram, Jai Jai Rama Ho. Let us close with three melodious ohms. Om.